Welcome back to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings on the industry you can regularly read over on The Wrap, and his musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can now listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Saturday, May 4th, 2024, which is, of course, Star Wars Day. Happy May the 4th to you, Drew.
Oh, thank you, Jim. This is a very spiritual day for us. And
well, I know, worth mentioning, though, I literally had somebody reach out to me yesterday and was like, hey, we're trying to get Herbie the Love Bug Day going, with the idea that, you know, Herbie had a 53 on the side of him. So, you know, the May 3rd should be Herbie Day. Mm. And it was one of these things where it was like, hang on, let me go over to the official day calendar. And it turns out that May 3rd is already Women's Equal Pay Day, International Wild Koala Day, Lumpy Rug Day, and National No Pants Day. And Drew, I think I speak for you. I wish I had known that, but had been an option yesterday.
Yeah. Well, you know, yesterday was also National Jindo Day, which is the kind of dog that I have.
Oh, well, so, now you see. Yeah. So you see that this is a very crowded day already. So yes. Apologies to the Herbie people. I mean, I know they mean well, but you know, I think this day's dance card is already pretty full. Okay. Anyway, back to Star Wars Day now. Given that this is an animation news podcast, I guess we should use May the 4th to mention that Star Wars The Bad Batch, that acclaimed series from Lucasfilm Animation, just ended its 3-season run over on Disney Plus this past week on Wednesday, May 1st. Went out strong with a supersized episode, 51 minutes long, and also worth noting, Drew, that it was 3 years ago today on May the 4th, 2021, when The Bad Batch debuted on that streaming service with an episode called Aftermath. And just today, if you head over to Disney Plus, they're dropping Tales of the Empire, which is it's an animated anthology that explores the dark side. Did you see this isn't exactly a sequel, it's kind of a follow-up, but I want to say it was back in October of 2022, the Star Wars Tales of the Jedi thing that they did. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Apparently, this is now a franchise within Lucasfilm Animation called Star Wars Tales. So there will be more Tales coming at some point. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think if you haven't seen them, they're little episodes between 13 and 17 minutes that explore the crucial backstory for some of the most important Star Wars characters. And they have teased that Darth Vader will be a part of this batch. So get ready, Jim.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, when we finish up here today, I'll go check that out. But anyway, we need to get this week's fine tuning officially underway here, which means Drew and I have to discuss this week's news. But before we do that, we have to take a brief moment to acknowledge our sponsor, and that is Touring Plans, which can save you time and money if you're headed down to Orlando anytime soon to scope out any number of the theme parks that now surround the City Beautiful. If you'd like to learn more about how Touring Plans can make your visit to the Magic Kingdom even more magical, or let's be honest here, just a little less stress-free, please check them out at touringplans.com, and you can thank Mr. Taylor and I later. So, okay, before we officially get to the news now, just a few quick follow-up items. We mentioned on last week's fine-tuning that friend of the show, Josh Gad, is making his directorial debut by helming a Chris Farley biopic. At that time, Mr. Taylor, again, as an industry vet, we should pay attention to, you know, his observations here. You were saying, hang on, let's not celebrate this film just yet, because they hadn't actually set up a studio, right? You know, I mean, it was announced, but didn't have a home yet.
Right. And it was a hot package that did not have a distributor or any of that. But that changed this week, didn't it, Jim?
It did. It did. And supposedly it was a pretty active bidding situation, but the film found a home. It's now at at New Line, right?
Yes.
Okay. And have to say, I am very much looking forward to this film, not just because Josh is directing, but also I have to say, I've been fascinated by the sad story of Chris Farley for over 25 years now. And oh, speaking of Mr. Gadd, the show that he and Andrew Rannells did on Broadway last year just got nominated for Tony for Best Revival of a Musical. And also, if you didn't get to see it, but you still want to hear it, the original cast album for Gutenberg the Musical became available for streaming yesterday, May 3rd. And if you want a physical copy, well, that doesn't hit store shelves till Friday, May 17th. Also, on last week's show, Drew and I mentioned that Ay Chihuahua, that animated feature that Jorge Gutierrez has had in development over at Netflix since, what, March of 2022, was officially dead, or at least there. It's worth noting that the streaming service gave Gutierrez permission to shop this project around, which was supposedly about a chihuahua that dreamed of being a masked wrestler, right? With Gabriel Fluffy Iglesias voicing the title character. Drew, yeah. We had another shoe drop this week. Do you want to share what Jorge had to say on social media?
Yes, I will share this. Okay. And I do want to say that I have heard that there is a possibility that it could go back to Netflix as a distributor if he actually sets it up somewhere and is still looking for a place to premiere the movie. So it could end up back on Netflix. But this is what he had to say. After six glorious years at my beloved Netflix, my time as a writer, director, creator is officially coming to a close on Cinco de Mayo. I put it in my contract, of course. I could not be more eternally grateful to every single person who believed in me while here. And I'm even more thankful to everyone I got lucky to work with. What spectacular crews I had the pleasure to collaborate with. What an adventure we had, unlike anything I have ever experienced before. Gracias from the bottom of my heart. More info soon.
Okay.
And, you know, he had kind of a rough go. You know, the studio that he had animate Maya and the Three wasn't, you know, ultimately shut down by Netflix because of lack of, you know, jobs that they were giving them. So, yeah, I thought, I hope he gets this movie made. I mean, you and I also were following, this was a series, it was a movie, it was, you know, nobody really knew. So I just want more Jorge product soon.
Oh, no, totally, totally. I mean, you know, in fact, it kind of makes me crazy that it will be a decade this fall since Book of Life came out. So, you know, it's been that long since we've had an animated feature. And more to the point, you mentioned Maya and the Three, which that 9-episode miniseries debuted on Netflix back in October of 2021. And I'm really kind of thrilled to hear news about if he can find another studio to animate Ay Chihuahua, that, you know, that Netflix is open to the idea of at least distributing it. But yeah, I love this guy's work. I love his sense of humor, his style of storytelling. You know, I want more Gutierrez stuff. So somebody who owns a studio or a production company somewhere, give this guy the time, the money, and the support to make a film, a new miniseries, anything. So, all right. Could use a little good news at this moment. So let's pivot now to talking about what just got announced from the Classic Television Network. These are the folks behind MeTV, which basically airs every single black and white sitcom from the 50s and the 60s. They've announced they're launching a brand new channel, which will showcase classic animation. In this case, that would be things like the animated shorts that Warner's released theatrically in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, not to mention many of the Saturday morning cartoons that Hanna-Barbera churned out in the 60s and the 70s. This new channel, which will be known as MeTV Toons, officially launches on June 25th. Also pleased to report that animation historian Jerry Beck will be creating new content for this MeTV spinoff. Also, Bob Bergen. He's the guy who's currently voicing Porky Pig and Marvin the Martian for Warner Brothers Television Animation. He's going to serve as the signature voice announcer for MeTV Toons. So it sounds like it's starting, getting off on the right foot. And I have to say, Drew, since I saw in the press materials for this that this is going to be the cable television home for Rocky and Bullwinkle, and it's been too long since Jay Ward stuff has been available. So I think this is good news. What do you think?
Yeah, is it also a fast channel on streaming MeTV, or is this only on cable?
That's an excellent question. I do not know. Tell you what, I'll drill down into that, and we'll share an update on that on the next show. But speaking of vintage stuff, if you have, so far anyway, missed out on seeing The Rocketeer, The Life and Legacy of Dave Stevens, this was an exhibition that was supposed to run at the Cartoon Art Museum up in San Francisco from September 23rd of last year through February 25th. Well, I've got some great news for you. The nice folks at 781 Beach Street, that's where the Cartoon Art Museum is located in San Francisco, they have decided to extend the run of The Life and Legacy of Dave Stevens through June 2nd of this year. So you still got one more month left to get up to the Bay Area and view all of this Rocketeer-related goodness in person. But if that's just not doable, not to worry. The Cartoon Art Museum has just announced that they are printing a limited edition exhibition catalog for The Rocketeer, The Life and Legacy of Dave Stevens. And in fact, if you're up in the San Francisco two Saturdays from now, that would be May 18th, they're going to hold a launch party for this publication. But again, if it's just not doable to get to the Bay Area between now and June 2nd, so you can pre-order this 58-page full-color softcover book for $29.99. It's supposed to ship later this month. On the other hand, Drew, when does the Art of Amphibia ship?
That will ship to you, Jim, on, I think, November 19th. And so,
I see. Yeah. Okay. And our Art of Ultraman Rising?
I don't know if that has a date yet, but it is currently getting approvals right now. So I'm finished with writing it. And I should be able to share, too, who we got to do the foreword very soon. So, yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I will learn more about this off air. Okay. Anyway, gratuitous plugs aside. Well, no, we still have more plugs there. Okay. Speaking of cartoon-related exhibitions, out in this neck of the woods, New England, the Norman Rockwell Museum, which is located in picturesque Stockbridge, Massachusetts, will be presenting What Me Worry, the Art and Humor of Mad Magazine, starting next month, on June 8th, to be exact. This exhibition, which will feature more than 150 original art pieces, plus some Mad Magazine-related memorabilia, dating back to the launch of this publication back in 1952. That's supposed to run through October 27th of this year. Anyway, me personally, always thought that Fairly Odd Parents had kind of a Mad Magazine vibe, and wanted to ask Drew if you saw the commercial that dropped just in the past week for Fairly Odd Parents, A New Wish, which, what, it debuts on Netflix on the 20th this month, right?
Yeah, this is a kind of live-action CG hybrid show. Or is this pure CG? Mm-hmm.
This one is, well, there was I know the one of What You Speak, that there was sort of an attempt.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, a live action with the Cosmo and Wanda as CG characters. This, on the other hand, is completely CG. But what's fascinating is they have leaned heavily into replicating the look of the original hand-drawn show. So they are very much cousins coming to the look and the style of the writing and that sort of thing, which, given the commonality with the creative team, is not really a surprise. But yeah, that 20-episode series debuts, as I mentioned, on May 20th on Nickelodeon and is then supposed to begin streaming internationally on Netflix later this year. And speaking of Netflix and speaking of commercials, earlier this week we saw the ad for Jurassic World Chaos Theory drop, which is a sequel to Camp Cretaceous, which also ran on the same streaming service from September of 2020 through November of 2022. They had 5 seasons and then a special that served as the animated series finale. And this time around, it's the kids from Camp Cretaceous kind of aged up. It's a couple of years after that show ended, and someone is trying to kill the kids only using raptors, you know, which I'm sorry, Drew, that seems like a little overkill, doesn't it?
Well,
you know,
just I like that they showed at the beginning of the trailer that the character played by Jenna Ortega died, which means that she was too expensive to bring back for the sequel series.
Oh,
you know, it's okay.
No, but what was kind of interesting, if you went online and followed the reaction to the trailer, you know, everyone was, oh, they're bringing her back. You know, she's not really dead. But I think your insight may be that much more on the money. It's like, how much to bring her back? Oh, no, she's definitely getting eaten by a raptor. So, all right. Anyway, that show debuts over on Netflix starting on May 24th. And speaking of animated series for streaming services that were based on theatrical release properties, did you see how well Knuckles has done for Paramount Plus?
Yeah.
Just to give you a little background, folks, this is a spinoff from the Sonic the Hedgehog film series, which started back in February 2020 with the original Sonic the Hedgehog movie and continues this coming holiday season, which is when Paramount Pictures will be releasing Sonic the Hedgehog 3 to theaters on December 20th. And please tell me that's not the same day Wicked Part 1 comes out. Am I remembering that correctly?
I think it's around the same time. This Christmas is getting pretty full. Yeah.
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 Wow. Okay. Anyway, so Knuckles is basically, again, a mini animated series that showcases events that evidently happened between Sonic the Hedgehog 2, which went out into theaters in April of 2022, and again, the aforementioned Sonic the Hedgehog 3, which again, we mentioned holiday season of this year. But anyway, it debuts just last week on that streaming service, April 26th, and please explain these numbers to me, because it did crazy viewing, didn't it? Like 4 million hours of viewing over, or is it 4 million minutes of viewing over the premiere?
I don't know if it's minutes or hours, but it was huge. I'll look right now.
But to put that in perspective, folks, supposedly this was a 278% jump in viewing for the average viewing day over at Paramount Plus. So they have to be thrilled with this sort of reaction.
Yes, it was a opening weekend record for Paramount Plus.
Wow.
A running time of 169 minutes across all 6 episodes. Knuckles' 4 million hours of viewing equates to about 1.42 million complete shows or views of the series in the opening weekend.
Wow.
So the only way it could have gotten more views is if it was called Taylor Sheridan's Knuckles, and then it would have really taken off.
Funny. Okay, yes. But true. Okay, so, all right, and again, so the folks at Paramount have to be thrilled with those numbers for Knuckles. I mean, mind you, they're not Bluey numbers. You know, they're not Bluey good, but and speaking of which, a couple of quick things related to that kid's animated series, and want to apologize for all of the owners of Australian cattle dogs out there who were offended by when I suggested that Australian cattle dogs weren't all that attractive. And anyone, did you see the Zillow ad this past week where they actually used really for real Australian cattle dogs to sort of recreate scenes from The Sign, the show where Bluey, Bandit, Bingo, and Chili were going to sell their home and move away?
No, I didn't see that. There are a group of Australian cattle dogs in my neighborhood that came from the same litter that are all named after X-Men characters. And let me tell you,
no.
Logan lives up to his name. A bit of a wild card. Let me just say that. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. All right, but again, you've experienced these dogs in real life. They are cute.
I think all dogs are cute, Jim, but yeah, I get what you're saying, that they look like God was asleep at the wheel when he was putting these things together. I get it. Yeah.
All right, there we go. All
Jim,
right.
Did you watch the John Mulaney special last night on Netflix?
No.
Okay, well, you got to watch it before next week. There's more episodes, but each episode is devoted to a different aspect of Los Angeles, and last night was all about coyotes. And he riffs on what coyotes are. It was absolutely hysterical. So you've got to watch it.
Is this a thing with Richard Kind?
Yes. Yeah. They did it live last night at 7 o'clock. I don't want to ruin any of the fun, but it was outstanding. So anyway.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I love me some Richard Kind. I love me some John Mulaney. I will definitely go for this. Okay.
Yes, you have to. Yeah.
Back to Bluey for a sec. We did talk on last week's show about Surprise, the episode of Bluey that dropped. And it turns out the surprise was that, there was a flash forward that showed Bluey as a mom with a pup of her own. And again, it shows you the world we live in right now, Drew, where for the past week, there has been all this online speculation about who the dad of Bluey's pup might be. And I'm told in Vegas now you can actually bet on this, and the smart money is on Mackenzie. And finally, our last bit of Bluey-related news. We were talking about, Disney's unique relationship with the folks who make Bluey and how it's interesting that Disney's involved here, and yet Bluey is not in a Disney theme park yet. Well, Drew, we seem to be heading that way. In fact, right now, headed to Boston, is Bluey's Big Play, which is a stage show that will be presented in the Box Center, at the Box Center in the Wang Theater, May 18th through the 19th. And what's interesting about the show, Drew, it's written by Bluey creator Joe Brum, features songs by Bluey's house composer, Geoff Bush, but it features large puppets that the performer, have you ever seen how they do Timon in the Broadway version of The Lion King? So, the performer is literally standing behind the almost full human-sized Timon puppet.
Yeah.
This is how they're doing Bluey for the stage show, so to speak. But anyway, this show started its North American tour yesterday, May 3rd in Chicago, heads next to Denver, May 11th through the 12th, makes a stop in Reading, Pennsylvania on the 15th and the 16th before the aforementioned Boston stop at the Wang Theater. Then it does a couple of stops up in Maine, in Portland or Bangor, before heading to Brooklyn May 25th through the 26th. And if you want to learn more about this tour, you can head over to bluey.tv and then click on the Bluey's Big Play link. But speaking of theme parks, when Drew and I get back, we are going to look at the Magic of Disney Animation attraction that was at Disney's Hollywood Studios. This theme park just celebrated the 35th anniversary of its grand opening this past week, and Drew suggested it might be interesting to take a look back at this, and I agreed, so we're going to do that in a sec. But first, this. And we're back. So, Drew, again, you suggested this topic. What are your strongest memories of the Magic of Disney Animation attraction at Disney MGM?
Well, I mean, I just remember, at one point it was part of the Backlot tour.
It was.
And you were just on that tour for how long, Jim? 2.5 hours, something like that?
Well, what was interesting, again, you're not wrong. The physical setup for the tram tour entrance was to the left, and the entrance to the Magic of Disney Animation was to the right, but they shared a common wall, and God help you if you got in the wrong line, because I want to tour the animation studio. Well, and particularly the first summer, it's, well, tough luck, pal. You're on a tram for, a half hour. And then we dump you out at the other end. And the only way back here is you had to take the walking tour. And that was a full hour. I mean, you got to see cool stuff.
There you go.
But yeah. But yeah, they literally shared a common wall. And after that first summer, they did. I mean, they threw open Mickey Avenue because moms especially, you know, were furious because it's like they'd leave their strollers, you know, with like the, you know, the baby's food and the change of clothes and then be told, yeah, get off the tram and where's my stroller? And it's like, well, it's a half mile that way. It just... Not a good thing. So, but anyway, so.
Yeah, no, I remember, you know, how magical it was to see people working. Yeah. And the other thing was that there was these other, like tours and experiences that you can do. And then, you know, so when I was a kid, I did one of the animation tours, you know, that you would pay more to do. And I remember walking backstage at the animation studio there, and I was like 10 or something, and I was asking, this was I think in the summer of 93 or 94, and I was asking about what the status of Mulan was, and the woman who was kind of guiding the tour was like, how do you know about Mulan? And it was because I would read the papers, Jim, and I would cut things out, and I, you know, it was such an exciting time for absolutely. Disney Animation, and so to be that close to it, yeah. You know, that I never went to LA when I was a kid, so I just remember it being a very powerful tool.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I, again, what's fascinating is that if you go all the way back to 1939, 1940, where Walt is staring down the barrel of World War II, and he's already seeing the international markets for his movies shut down, and the whole notion of we're going to need another revenue stream, you know, especially to pay back the Bank of America. And he began looking at an actual tour of how do we get people in here and get them to pay a quarter to look through the glass and us making a movie. And they could never figure that out. And so for Florida to do this, to build the what did they call it? The fishbowl?
The fishbowl. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, did you see Tom Bancroft on Instagram was in Star Wars launch bay going, okay, here's where here's where layout was. Here's where, you know, it's such a shame that went away.
It is. It was, and in fact, there's so many aspects of the history of Walt Disney Feature Animation Florida. In fact, I mean, on the heels, you were just mentioning Mulan. And face it, initially, the whole point of this satellite studio was what? They were supposed to make theatrical shorts. In fact, Roller Coaster Rabbit. In fact, just recently, His Eminence Bio Reconstruct, was referring to when he worked at Feature Animation Florida, and his job was working out the computer animation of the roller coaster tracks in you know, the latter part of that short. And but it was wasn't it when Little Mermaid hit as big as it did, and suddenly it's like we need one of these every year.
Right.
Suddenly it's all hands on deck, and now Florida has to really step up.
Well, I think didn't they did part of the first Roger Rabbit short, and then they did all of the rest of them. So it was sort of like there was a little bit of a curve, which, you know, we often talk about.
Yeah. Well, no, and in fact, it's so funny you bring up the learning curve, because that's the, you know, the infamous story about what I think the first chunk of a theatrically released film they got handed was Kill the Beast from Beauty and the Beast, which, again, that came out in 91. Mm-hmm. And I've never gotten the story straight, because California has one version of the story and Florida has a different version of the story. But evidently, Florida got handed an old set of model sheets for the folks who lived in Bell's Village. And they religiously adhered to the old look. And then, but out in California, I guess they had, you know, they finally animated the bell number at the front of the film. And I guess they assembled the work in progress, and people were like, I don't recognize anybody from the beginning of the film in the bell number to kill the beast. And they had to do this last minute sort of reanimation of certain parts to make it them fit together better. And eventually it's like, look, like 50 minutes of screen time have gone by. Nobody's ever, one was set during the day, another one set at night, and there's torch fire and that sort of thing. Nobody's going to notice. And it's just, but the problem with that explanation is that once the villagers make it to the Beast Castle, that part is now animated by California again, and suddenly those characters look like the people from the village at the beginning of the movie, and it's like, so what happened to the walkover? Everybody got a makeover? Just, ugh. But the interesting part of it is because that happened, supposedly, the folks in California, let's not let that happen again. All right, tell you what, we've got Lion King teeing up. So let's give them something that doesn't look like anything in the rest of Lion King. And they got handed I Just Can't Wait to Be King, which they knocked out of the park. I mean, it looked amazing. And that in turn is what got them permission to do Lilo and Stitch in Mulan, as you mentioned. And then because they were doing so much good work, they went for their tiny little building, and then that set of trailers that were out to the back they built them a $70 million production facility that opened, I want to say, in April of 1998. And what was especially sad about that is this was the first time they went to animators and said, if we're building you a building, what do you need? So they were the ones who were like, well, we need giant doors because we're constantly carrying storyboards in and out of conference rooms. And we need elevators that can help us carry the giant boards. And yeah.
Yeah. Weren't there desks? I've heard stories about what their desks cost. Oh. They were like $40,000 desks for everybody. Yeah. Yeah,
but they did amazing work there, and again, it's I love that you mentioned the Bancrofts, because hang on one sec, who was your friend again? Was it Tom? It was Tom, right? Tom Bancroft. We would go visit Tom at the studio. In fact, at one point, Tom very early on had slipped us a piece of a model sheet for Mushu, and my dad, who was a wood carver, actually made a wood toy of Mushu. And I have to understand, we bring it into the studio. The Mulan toys haven't showed up yet, but here is somebody has made a Mushu toy, and Tom was carrying it around the show. There's a toy! Somebody made a toy! Look at a toy based on our character. But yeah, it was...
Well, there were a lot of really important filmmakers and animators down there between Aaron Blaze and Chris Sanders and... Yeah. You know, Byron Howard told me this story one time that he was, before the studio had been built, there was basically a sign out front saying Disney Animation coming soon. And he basically hopped off the tram tour and, went and found a job. I mean, that was literally, he was one of the first people hired, and he was, in the fish tank regularly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you're not wrong. I mean, for example, we just had Mark Henn retire from the Walt Disney Company, and he was it was a very big deal that Mark agreed to leave LA and go and work at the studio in Florida. In fact, I think as part of that deal, he got to direct John Henry at one point, but... But yeah, no, so many amazing talents. In fact, Nancy and I were just talking about Elliot Bohr. He's did Eleanor of Avalor for Disney, and I remember seeing his name on a new animated series for them. But yeah, I mean,
he was from there. Yeah.
Okay, a lot of talent. A lot of people. Got there. So, but again, that was the interesting thing about Florida, was that the established artists at the studio, so to speak, it's like, I don't want to move to Florida. And so it was like the young kids who agreed to go to Florida and start a new life there. In fact, that was really the saddest part of the story, is that studio opens in April of 89, and these people make big movies for Disney. In fact, it was very interesting after The Lion King that Disney entered that period where films were making less, and there were great concerns out in the corner office about why are movies making less, but it was, I want to say, Mulan bucked that trend. It actually made more at the box office than the animated features that came before it. And what was that? That was Hunchback and Hercules.
Pocahontas.
Yeah. And then, of course, Lilo and Stitch hit. And that only made $250 million at the box office, but on the other hand, sold billions of dollars in plush and launched several animated series and a bunch of home premieres and that sort of thing. And in fact, we've got the live-action Lilo and Stitch coming to Disney Plus or theatrical release. We don't know which, someday soon. But do you have a favorite memory of, I mean, obviously, if you did the backstage, did you get to paint your own cell? Was that part of the...
I painted my own cell in the little extra, aww, you know, thing that I did. Yeah, it was really great. It was a Mickey cell, I remember. And I, you know, carried it around with me for the rest of the day and all that. But yeah, I mean, the experience of going through this tour was really special. I loved the short film with Robin Williams and Walter Cronkite. And I also loved that little bit of animation they did before they showed you previews of what was to come with Michael and Mickey.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Which is, you know, one of the best. Yeah.
that film is worth it alone for the interaction between Chernabog and Michael Eisner.
You know, yes.
Sorry, Mr. Eisner, it won't happen again. You know,
but do you remember at the end of the tour before that, the kind of preview film was that there were those maquettes were actually in that building, and sometimes they were for movies that were a long way off, and that was where before special features and YouTube and everything, it was like that was the only place you could see this stuff.
I mean, and in fact, that's the very first place I got to see Ken Melton's. We just talked about his sad passing on our recent Fine Tuning, but that's the first place I ever got to see his stuff up close. And I remember, and you're not wrong, I think it's 91 that they had the maquettes in there for Aladdin. And it's like, oh my God, this movie is going to be amazing. Look at Iago, look at Jafar, look at the amazing design on these characters. But yeah, I mean, it did what it was supposed to. You left there with a strong appreciation for the actual art of animation, but at the same time, you also left pumped for the films that were going to be coming out soon from Disney. And again, Mr. Bancroft is not wrong. It does kind of break my heart. And I go in there to check out Star Wars related stuff for as part of Launch Bay, and it's like, I mean, this was the room where, you know, for example, I got to see the storyboards for Mickey's Arabian Adventure, the follow-up to, what was it, the Prince and the Pauper that never got made, or I remember being pressed up against the window and looking down and seeing somebody work on Hair in Your Soup, the Roger Rabbit short that Spielberg killed because of the pissing contest that went on over what went out with Dick Tracy. That was Roller Coaster Rabbit, right? Not
but he wanted it attached to Arachnophobia, is that what it
was? That's right. The Thrill-omedy.
The Thrill-omedy, yes, yes.
yes, another great name placed in the Jeffrey Katzenberg book of things that people didn't embrace, right up there with Tridigital. Okay. Yes. So, but anyway, story, they had done Brother Bear. That opened in October of 2003. They had been working on My Peoples, which kind of ironic because that really was a Tridigital movie. The human characters in that movie were going to be hand-drawn, and the little pieces of folk art that Hal Holbrook and Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton. Yeah, those who were CG. And boy, the name of that began to, you know, first it was My Peoples, then it was Angel and Her No Good Sister, and finally, A Few Good Ghosts? And then I want to say in the fall of 2003, we heard that movie had been put on hold and only to then be canceled. And then January 2004, in fact, it was David Staten who was in charge of the studio at that point, right?
Yeah.
He went down.
Not a well-loved figure.
No, he was not. But again, he was carrying all water for Eisner. Eisner was looking at the fact that, what, they had the studio in Paris, they had the television production facility in Australia, they obviously had the studio in L.A., and they had the one in Florida, and it's like, look, let's bring the best artists back. That they believed that the problem they were having is that the films weren't turning out as well as they could have because the artists were scattered to the four corners of the globe. So it's like, all right, let's bring all the talent home and put it under one roof and see what we can do. And also, let's be honest, this was also during the same time that Disney was thinking, maybe we need to get out of the hand-drawn business and pull at Pixar, you know, do just strictly CG. And
what could have gone wrong? What could have gone wrong? But, you know, I feel like that tour in Florida was such a wonderful, not only an exhibition of what made them so special, but a recruiting tool,
totally,
of future animators.
Totally. I mean, you looked in the window. And again, there was that period from, this would have been January of 93 till, I want to say, 95, 96. I was an Orlando local with an annual pass. And, you know, when invariably family would come to town or friends would come to town, we'd do a day at the studios. And that's the thing. You just show up and look and see what they're working on. And I've talked on previous fine tuning about how I was there the day that Jeffrey Katzenberg came to say goodbye in 94, and we literally watched him being mobbed by all of these people who worked with him, and he had come to Florida to say goodbye, and none of us knew at the time that he was also there on a recruiting trip. It's like, hey, I'm setting up my own animation studio, and, you know, maybe, you know, wait for a call from me. But yeah, just to be there for moments like that, or when friends would take me backstage, and I mean, you know, we haven't even talked about how in the satellite parking lot for the entrance backstage to Disney MGM, there was the special projects area, and there were like 8 or 10 trailers that had been slapped together. And this was where, for example, Drew, they had people from Florida in between working on things like Mulan and Stitch and that sort of thing. That's where they worked on like the animation elements for Light Magic. So, I mean, I remember getting taken into the conference room and seeing the mock-ups for the street tracular floats and the pieces of animation they had to create to bridge together the clips that were shown there. It was a wonderful setup. It was a great thing to go visit. It was important to the start of a lot of people's careers. And as you mentioned, it's both fun and kind of sad to have a Tom Bancroft or Tony Bancroft walking around what used to be the fishbowl. And it's like, okay, this was here, that was there. And if you move the Darth Vader outfit, this is where the water cooler was. But
yeah. Well, and the other interesting thing is that, you know, the Back to Neverland short, which I think is so fantastic, and you can watch on YouTube, mm-hmm. but yeah. The outfit that the genie wears at the end of Aladdin,
yes,
is actually,
yes,
an homage,
yep,
to the outfit that Robin Williams wears in live action at the beginning of this short, right?
And to bring this thing full circle, folks, if you watch Once Upon a Studio, and there's the scene where Olaf is sitting at an animation desk. In fact, this bit in the film ends with Robin Williams' genie character sort of bursting out of the animation desk. And he actually does a line they cut from.
Yeah, there is a lot. You know, as we were talking about, mm-hmm, a few weeks ago, our good friend Eric Goldberg, yep, is, you know, doing other things. But, mm-hmm, he one time showed me some of the alts that Robin Williams did. And I mean, I was just in stitches, just listening to it play out of his computer. So they have so much stuff and so much stuff that, you know, would have made, mm-hmm, Aladdin the first NC-17 rated Disney,
yes,
animated
Very
feature.
True. Very, yes, true.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what you were going to say, who runs by in the background? Well, yeah, that scene.
You have Olaf in the foreground, and at one point Timon says, "Hey, Frosty, shake a leg." And I think Josh's character says, "It's not in the leg, it's in the wrist." You know, but just ahead of Timon and Pumbaa floating down the hallway is Robin Williams' little lost boy character from the Back to Neverland movie that as Drew mentioned, was part of the magic of Disney Animation Attraction at Disney MGM. And just want to note that's one of the many great things for the Disney parks that Jerry Reese did. And just absolutely loved that film. And just, it again, just kind of broke my heart that it lost its home at the studio. And but again, it lives on as so many things do on YouTube these days. So, but anyway, okay, thanks to Drew for suggesting this as a feature topic, which again, very appropriate given we're, you know, just now celebrating the 35th anniversary of, you know, the opening of the studio that was formerly known as Disney MGM, now Disney Hollywood Studios. And by the way, if you enjoy Hollywood related stories, you have to listen to Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, which Drew does with the equally talented Charles Hood. The past couple of weeks, you have been marching through some of the great, great directors who have made movies for Paramount. I know Penelope Spheres, but you had just started on another filmmaker, and I
think it was it might have been Alexander Payne.
There we go. That's okay.
What we're finishing up. Yeah, we've done Zaz, we've done Howard Deutsch. And we've got some great episodes coming up. We talked to Sean S. Cunningham, Jim, who directed the first Friday the 13th.
No, I just...
He's got a lot of great stories.
Have you already interviewed him or...
We have recorded it, yes. But what should I have asked, Jim?
Well, no, I actually know the guy who put up the money for the original Friday the 13th. He was telling these great stories about, well, if you watch the movie today, it's one of these things where it's like, well, they're there for the opening of a summer camp. They're there ahead of the kids because, well, kids cost money. But again, you know, but the thing of it is, if, you know, like, well, wait a minute, you're there in the spring. Why are the leaves changing colors? Well, it's because they didn't get it in the spring. They got it at the tail end of the season. So these poor actors, anytime you see somebody go into the water for the original Friday the 13th film, they're shooting in late September, early October. These people are freezing to death, which I mean this in the kindest possible way. I realize we have a family-related audience, but the producers were not unhappy about this aspect of the shooting when it came to the young female actresses that they would send into the water?
I
don't need to explain further. Yeah. But again, good, we're going to be a PG-13. Woo! You know, but yeah, and I once got to talk with Tom Savini about how they take out Kevin Bacon in that. Remember the arrow that comes up?
The
bottom of the bed, you know, that building that appliance. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the Friday the 13th film, but I love the stories of the making of it. It was such a guerrilla operation, and the fact that it made as much money as it did. And Paramount, when they acquired the distribution rights, were like, "Thank you, we will take this over now." And
yes, yeah. Frank Mancuso.
There we go.
Jr.
There we go. Those guys. There we go. Yeah. Those guys. Yeah. No, great. They have amazing stories. And I'm sure Sean has just as good. I can't wait. Can't wait for that.
And as you know, Jim, as you get older, you really care less about who you're going to offend. Well, no. So, you know, this is the prime time. No.
You want to grapple more. When they're past the moment of caring, that's when you get the good stories.
Yes.
And speaking of good stories, we share a few of those over at the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. We got a couple other podcasts we'd love you to check out. Let's see. We have, of course, The Mothership, Disney Dish, I do with Len Testa. We have, of course, Looking at Lucasfilm. In fact, Brian Gunn today is braving the crowds down at Disneyland to do the May the 4th specific events that are being held in Black Spire Outpost. Let's see.
Did you see the hat that they're selling, Jim? That's kind of an homage to the old Goofy hat. That's a Jar Jar Binks hat with the ears and everything.
No! Oh, yeah. I don't need more crap here at the house. Okay. All right. I've been fighting the urge to get the Jabba the Hutt popcorn bucket, which looks like it's 5 feet long and would take up a lot of space. But now that hat. Oh.
You might have to text Brian Gunn and get him to get me the little die-cast Starspeeder 1000 that they're selling.
All right. I will actually add that to the list. Okay, okay. Cool. And also, speaking of merch, I do the I Want That Too with Lauren Hersey. And in fact, episode just dropped that we do the history of the Muppets at Disney and Brian Henson's desperate attempts to get out from under the mouse's shadow. And also, of course, we have the podcast I do with Lauren's husband, Eric Hersey, who edits a lot of the shows here at Jim Hill Media, produces a number of the podcasts, and he and I do the Epic Universal podcast, and that's been a lot of fun as well.
Lots to talk about there, huh? This week.
This week especially, yeah. Yes. Between the Super Nintendo announcement and all of the stuff that's going to open in Florida this summer. But and also worth noting that we also have our first ever video show, the one I do with Len and veteran Imagineer Jim Shule. And this month we are looking on Disney Unpacked. We are looking back at the history of the Disney stunt shows, and to give the late great Aaron Adams credit, I don't know where he found this footage, but he literally has images of Tinkerbell sliding off of the Matterhorn into the mattress at the end. You know, you actually get to see this performer at full speed into the mattress. So, but anyway, that's what we're doing over there. But we're also doing some stuff on social media. Speaking of which, Drew, if folks are looking for you on social media, where can they find you?
They can find me at Drew Tailored, like a tailored jacket, on all platforms. And yeah, I'm still tweeting, still whatevering.
I'm Xing, I'm Twittering over there. So you can find me on X, Twitter, and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook is Jim Hill Media News. Okay, one final favor, folks, before Drew and I head out the door here. If you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well, not just the show you're listening to right now, Fine Tuning, but also Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. That would be helpful. And I think that's going to do it for this week, folks. Mr. Taylor has to scamper out the door here for a junket. Are we allowed to talk about what junket it is, or people should?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's the junket for Atlas, the new Jennifer Lopez action movie. Sci-fi movie, whatever you want to call it. Simu Liu is in it, Jim, so yeah.
Oh, okay. So Shang-Chi. All right. You got to get to talk with him. I know Jennifer's off the table.
I might talk to him. I'm talking to the director today, so
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, again, you can read that, the wonderful stories that Drew will develop from that junket over on The Wrap. But speaking of wrap, let's wrap things up now. And we will see you folks next week with a brand new episode of Fine Tune.